So as we develop this insight practice, we can have many different kinds of insights. We can have insights into our bodies, into our postures, emotional insights, psychological insights, insights into our aspirations, insights into our fears and anxieties. So there's a lot of different kinds of insights we can have. And all those insights we have, they're really valuable insights. They can be very important in our lives and our practice. But at the heart of this insight practice is what are called the three liberating insights. The insight into the three characteristics, these universal characteristics that are present for all of us. And that's impermanence, unsatisfactoriness or suffering, the range of that, and not self. We typically don't just casually experience these insights. It takes a developing of the mind to create the environment for these insights to be able to arise. And just like a dancer, you know, needs to cultivate flexibility and strength and certain movements and, you know, before they can really fully express their most refined aspects of their art. But anybody can dance, you know, and just like, you know, as we practice, at any point in the practice, we can get these really wonderful insights. But as we continue to develop the mind, we can develop the mind in a way that really creates the conditions for these three liberating insights. And so that's the theme for the retreat, cultivating the qualities in the mind that create the conditions for these liberating insights to arise. And those qualities are stability of mind, well-being, and confidence. And so, you know, we can't force ourselves to have an insight, you know. So it's really important as we practice to and develop these qualities, to not be pushing forward to try to get them. You know, it works. For instance, if you're trying to create steadiness of mind, any movement towards the future, you know, kind of takes away the steadiness. So we just create the conditions and kind of know that that this is the direction, that this is where we're going. The insights are something that we can keep really close to us, because we can use them at any point in time. We can use the basic idea of impermanence. You know, as you go to the lunch table, this might not be your liberating insight, but this food isn't going to satisfy me for very long, you know. So maybe I don't have to, you know, invest all my attention on it, desire on it, you know. So we can just use that, you know, keep those close to us, the awareness that nothing, you know, nothing in our lives is going to give us this permanent satisfaction. So the power of mental stability is really what allows us, you know, that really stable mind that allows for us to really be able to see impermanence come and go. If the mind's like a little bit too restless, you know, it's very hard to see that arising and falling away of experience. A sense of well-being can really support us when we meet suffering, when we meet unsatisfactoriness, so we don't contract and fall into that suffering and unsatisfactoriness. So the well-being gives us the room and the spaciousness to be able to meet those things. And a sense of confidence is what gives us the balance to really be able to allow the insight into not self to arise. And insight, where all our reference points of who we are irrelevant. And so having a confidence, a deep confidence in and trust in ourselves and trust in the practice, allows us to feel safe enough to let go of the reference points of identity, of who we think we are. So in the next few days, our teachings are going to begin with, Gil and I will teach on the first on the three qualities of stability, confidence, well-being. And then the next teachings later in the retreat will be on the three characteristics. And, excuse me. I'd like to emphasize that one of the things that that's particularly helpful in creating the conditions for these for insight is the continuity of practice. And I know I think a couple of people really mentioned that as their aspiration on this retreat, which is great, to keep that really close to us and to really consider all the in-between moments in our retreat day as just as important as our time sitting on the cushion, as our time doing walking meditation, so that the bell rings and we move. And that movement has just as much care and attention, and we value it just as much as we did watching our breath in the formal sitting posture. There's all these in-between moments in our days. We're standing in line, waiting to eat, standing meditation, brushing our teeth meditation, combing our hair, taking our socks off meditation. Just every moment, just keeping that continuity. And then we lose the continuity. We just come back, just like we come back when we lost the awareness of our breath. We just keep coming back to the moment, back to the moment. This continuity starts to give us a lot of stability of mind and a lot of confidence in our ability to show up for our lives regardless of what's happening. This retreat is a really special opportunity that we have to set down our concerns from our daily lives, to set down the narratives of our lives, to really simplify ourselves, our lives, to just our felt experience, just now. What this is right now, without the stories, without any of the cares and concerns of the world, just this right now. This body has everything we need, this body. So thank you.
I think of the formal beginning of the retreat is when we do a little ritual of going for refuge and reciting the precepts. And it's common to do at these retreats at the beginning, and anything that's common, it can become rote and routine, and therefore not really thought about or considered deeply. And thereby, the great value of these two things, refuges and precepts, is lost on us. And for some, maybe for one of you, this retreat, and maybe it's you, what I'm about to say about the refuge and the precepts is going to be the most important thing of the whole retreat. So you don't want to miss it if you're the one. So the refuges and precepts are not something that lives outside of you. They are you, they are in you. And the refuges being the Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha, the essence is not something out there, the Buddha out there, but rather are mirrors for your own heart, for your own precious heart, for your citta, for your capacity for awareness, wisdom, compassion, care. We have an amazing potential and capacity within us. And to honor it, to revere it, to care for it, to protect it, to grow it and develop it, and finally to liberate it. To liberate the heart is one of the best things you can do in this life. And so to begin recognizing what a great resource you have, what a great thing you have in there, and to take refuge in that, to find your support, your guidance in what's already in here, by seeing it first in the mirror, maybe. So we have a very dramatic mirror here on the altar. We have the statue of the Buddha. And it's meant as kind of a mirror. It's, you know, not so many of you look exactly like that person up there. But something inside, an inner sensibility, to sense yourself from the inside out, when you're really settled in the practice, when the practice comes alive in your body, will feel something like what that statue represents. It's that statue will represent you in some way, we hope. And the Dharma could be the teachings. It could be... So someone recently, last week, gave a wonderful definition for the Dharma. I was delighted by it. She said, the Dharma is the process by which reality comes to, finds its, the process by which reality finds its peace. Is that close enough, Shelley, to what you heard, we heard? The way that Dharma is the process by which the reality finds itself way to peace. I loved it because it wasn't, it was impersonal. It wasn't like how you'll find your peace. And maybe that's not even the point for you to become liberated. But through you, reality gets liberated. Because if it's only about you, we're in trouble. And if your good heart is only about you, you're in trouble. Luckily, your good heart, your precious heart, your citta, your inner life, is so much vaster and so much filled with more potential than what you know about yourself and what you, how you identify yourself and how you think about yourself. And so the Dharma is this vast world of the teachings, of these amazing natural processes that operate, that when they're operating, and when they're operating smoothly, when they're operating to their best capacity, they are liberating. They are the means by which the heart finds how to let go, how to release what it's holding on to and gripping. And the Sangha is, you know, two things usually, the external Sangha. It's the Sangha is the monastic community, and very grateful that we have a monastic here at this retreat. It's a wonderful offering to have this kind of life. I think of a monastic life as a gift to our society, and I appreciate it so much. And so, Viveka, thank you for coming here and sharing your gift with us. The Sangha is also those people who have tasted the liberation that Buddhism is pointing towards, who have some taste, some experience of it. They know it for themselves. And what they know for themselves is what's in them, is what goes on in their own heart. And so the people externally who represent the Sangha, again, are mirrors for what is in us, what can be in us, what we're growing into within us. So to take refuge, it's an interesting word, and I try to remember not to say to take refuge, because that seems acquisitive, kind of greedy. I'll take more refuge in you. but the bigger portion. But the traditional language uses the Pali word gacchami, which means to walk or to go. And so to go for refuge. And that has a very different feeling than to take refuge. To go for refuge is you bring your, when you go walk someplace, you bring your whole body, your whole being with you. You don't send your mind out ahead. And, it's something you do completely. And so to completely step into the refuge, into the support, into the protection, into the inspiration, into the faith that yes, the big yes to this, what this amazing process we're involved in. And the classic idea of refuge is that refuge, one of the forms of refuge is not a blind act of faith, but it involves a knowing of what this path and what this practice is about. And so when you really know it, and then you want to align yourself with it, you want to harmonize yourself to it, or want to commit yourself to it, or want to be supported by it, that's what going for refuge implies, or what it speaks to. And we're going for refuge into our own hearts. But it's hard to do this alone. And it's hard to do this thinking it's all about my efforts and I have to do this myself. And so it's very helpful to know there's actually a bigger Dharma process here that's supporting us. It's not just us practicing, we're being practiced. And to take refuge is to relax the self-centered focus on me, myself, and mine. It's all about me and my success and my effort to try to accomplish something, or to be so overwhelmed by some, there's tremendous difficulties that can come, emotional difficulties and all kinds of things can arise on practice. But to know that you're being held in the lap of the Buddha, in the palms of the Buddha, you're being held by a vast field of goodness, of compassion, and of a liberating process that is built into the structures of our hearts, that you don't always remember that's there. So sometimes going for refuge is most powerful when we have forgotten what's in us. We've forgotten the path, or forgotten our trust in it, or faith in it, and you kind of rely on something which is bigger than you, greater than you. And maybe that which is bigger and greater than you lives in your heart. It's not like, some strange thing out in the universe out there in the astral realm. It's in this heart. Something bigger than you that lives in your heart. What do you think of that? So for some people going for refuge, it can be inspired by our fellow practitioners. On a retreat, this particular era of Dharma practice in this world, and all the different times down through the centuries that people have engaged in the practice, there's been a tremendous momentum of practice that's been passed on warm hand to warm hand from one generation to the next, people who've experienced this, who've tasted it, who've gone through all the problems you've gone through and seen it to the other end. And because people have done that, it's come down to us. And this is our generation. This is our time to do this. And perhaps we will also realize the Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha in ourselves and pass it on with our warm hands to the next generation. So we go for refuge. We walk for refuge. The second thing we do at the beginning of retreat is the language of taking the precepts maybe is a little bit more appropriate. But you can say you go for the precepts, but I go for the precepts. It seems a little, that seems, saying that in English, in my English, just seems to make the precepts kind of far away. But to take the precepts means you bring them close. And so you want to have the precepts really close. So that, if you feel like, you know, you want to take more, you're welcome to take as much as you'd like. You know, pile it on, you know. There's lots of it. But to take the precepts. The precepts are what we do both for our own sake, but also we do it for our sake of our community. It's a powerful thing we're involved in here. It's one of the most powerful things that I know a person can do, to do this kind of practice here. And we're touching sometimes the most difficult and deepest and tenderest parts of our inner life, and putting ourselves in a situation of tremendous vulnerability and all kinds of things can happen in this environment, this kind of practice. And we want to be able to trust. We want to be able to feel safe in this environment. So it's really okay to open up and to allow what's bubbling up inside of us to really show itself and to be there. And so it's very important to create a field of safety for each other. And I'm quite confident that this is a very safe group of people to be with. I don't think there's going to be a lot of killing and stealing and such things in this retreat. But we might know that, but the subconscious doesn't necessarily know that. Deep in our hearts, there might be, who knows what's happened to different ones of us that leaves us mistrusting, leaves us afraid, leaves us kind of isolated from each other or something. And so when we go for refuge, when we take the precepts publicly out loud, we're kind of speaking to something deeper than our conscious mind. So something inside can soften and relax and trust this process. Because without a deep trust in something that's deeper than what we can know, it's really hard to let the Dharma practice us. So the first precept is not to harm, not to kill, and certainly no intentional harming of each other, but also a no-taking of life. So that includes insects and mice. There's been a lot of compassionate mice catching here at IRC. We spent a lot of time and money to have compassion for these mice. I hope the mice appreciate it. it would have been a lot cheaper to kill them. But we don't do that. This is a safe place for mice. Though they don't, it's safe enough. We catch them. And then we've learned that you can't really take a mouse very far away without kind of jeopardizing its life or its health and well-being. So the idea is when you catch a mouse and it's have a heart trap, you just put them outside the door of your house, right outside, really close by, so they're close to where they live. And then you make sure your house is sealed. So that's what we've been doing, right? Sealing and sealing, and there's a lot, big building, right? So there's a lot of things to seal. Anyway, not killing. Why don't we kill? Many reasons we don't kill. But we don't kill so we don't kill something in our own heart. We're caring for ourselves. Then the second precept is not to take what is not given. A little bit higher commitment than just not stealing. If it hasn't been offered, don't take it. And if you need it or something, then check with someone and see if it can be offered. And I think that's a beautiful act of letting go, of trusting, of being open, of I think a profound trust in life. To see what will be offered so that I can live my life. And a lot is offered here at IRC. You know, it's kind of remarkable that the whole thing's offered for free. I mean, you know, we could probably rent this place out. I wonder how much these rooms would go for, Inez. And everything's offered free, and the yogi need clothes. Have you, some of you checked it out and seen what's freely offered there? And food is offered. So there's so much, you know, you can trust that you're being taken care of here. And that ability to trust for what's being offered is a profound thing to experience and to be with. And then there's not harming through our sexuality, no sexual misconduct. And on retreat, certainly the expectation on retreat is that everyone is celibate. But more than that, less than that, I don't know how to say this, but more or less, that we also can harm other people by how we look at them. If we look at them sexually, we can somehow our sexual energy and interests and fantasies can spill over, and it might seem innocent enough to go sit near someone because it's the person's kind of cute. And who knows what that vibe that person's getting? Who knows what history that person's had with harm done to them sexually and all kinds of things? And you don't know what you're setting in motion. We don't expect you to have no sexual fantasy when you're here. You know, if there was no sexual fantasy for 40 people for 7 days, I think I'd worry a little bit. But keep it to yourself. So don't let your sexual energy and interest or whatever spill out. That means not to harm through your sexuality. And then speak the truth. The actual wording of it is, don't speak falsehoods. No, so don't speak what is false. Don't lie. Don't deceive. And that goes directly in alignment with what mindfulness is. Mindfulness is a practice of being honest. It's being honest with oneself. And honesty, telling the truth is just mindfulness out loud, if it's done wisely. And so we go direct to completely opposite direction from where the practice is going when we start lying. And so, why practice if you're going to go, you're kind of messing it up? It's a beautiful thing. Profoundly beautiful thing to have the ease of heart that comes from telling the truth. It really supports this practice and allows other people to relax around us. And then finally, the fifth precept is not to consume intoxicants. And, we have a society that has a huge problem with the drugs and alcohol. And this is an oasis from that. And we don't know who's here. Some of you might be people who come out of an addictive background and struggled with it. And it's a great event that you've managed to step away from all that, be in recovery. And we want to support people who are in recovery and people who have a history of struggling with this and make it a safe place. And if some people go off and kind of intoxicate themselves on retreat, it kind of either, by osmosis, it kind of spills over into the scene. And you don't know who you're harming and who you're threatening and challenging by it. But also you're challenging yourself. It also goes against the grain of what mindfulness is about. Buddhist practice is to wake up and be clear. And so why would you do something that would maybe make you feel good, but really compromises your capacity to really see and be wise. So to take the precepts is not just an ethical issue. To take the precepts is to also trust again. Deep, deep trust, kind of like that there is, you have within you amazing capacities towards freedom. And you interfere with it. You mess it up with selfishness when you actively are involved with doing the opposite of the five precepts. So it's a way of caring for yourself. It's a way of not messing it up. It's a way of trusting and allowing this powerful Dharma practice to work through you. So we do a little ritual of chanting these as a way of bringing our voices together and starting together as a community here, and so that our subconscious can hear all this. And when we chant the refuges, we do it three times, because sometimes it's hard to penetrate into the subconscious, deep in the heart. So we're kind of like, okay, I really mean it. Let's do it again. And then we do the precepts. So in the refuges, we'll recite in Pali. I'll do a whole line, and then you can repeat after me. For those of you who have never heard it before, it might be hard to follow it that way, but you get full credit for humming along. You know, it's a foreign language anyway, and few of you know what it actually, the words actually are. But it's literally, first we do the salutation to the Buddha, just kind of paying our respects to the Buddha. And then we say, I go for refuge in the Dharma, I go for refuge in the Dharma, I go for in the Buddha, in the Dharma, and the Sangha. And then we do it a second time and a third time. And then we'll do the precepts in English, and I'll tell you how we do that. So you can repeat after me. No, after me. I'll do the whole sentence, because that's later we'll chant together. But for this ceremony, it's the way it kind of has greater power, supposedly, is that I do it first with all my authority. and then you repeat. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddham saranam gacchami. Dhammam saranam gacchami. Sangham saranam gacchami. Dutiyampi Buddham saranam gacchami. Dutiyampi Buddham saranam gacchami. Dutiyampi dhammam saranam gacchami.
Dutiyampi dhammam saranam gacchami.
Dutiyampi sangham saranam gacchami. Tatiyampi Buddham saranam gacchami.
Tatiyampi Buddham saranam gacchami.
Tatiyampi Dhammam saranam gacchami.
Tatiyampi Dhammam saranam
Tatiyampi Sangha? Sangha saranam gacchami.
Tatiyampi Sangham saranam gacchami.
So then we'll do the precepts, and I'll do half the line, half the sentence in English, and then you repeat, and then I'll do the second half and you can repeat. For the sake of our practice together,
for the sake of our practice together,
I commit myself not to kill.
I commit myself not to kill.
For the sake of our practice together,
for the sake of our practice together,
I commit myself not to take what is not given.
I commit myself not to take what is not given.
For the sake of our practice together, I commit myself to avoid sexual misconduct.
I commit myself to avoid sexual misconduct.
For the sake of our practice together.
For the sake of our practice together.
I commit myself not to speak falsehoods.
I commit myself not to speak falsehoods.
For the sake of our practice together.
For the sake of our practice together.
I commit myself to not taking intoxicants. So thank you for doing that. I have tremendous appreciation for people who engage in those two things, the refuges and the precepts. I don't take it lightly. I don't take it as a rote routine. I consider it as a very important part of the retreat and the support for the retreat. And some of you might feel some difficulty during the course of the retreat. You might call upon the refuges or call upon the precepts, remember them. And maybe that'll see you through the challenging times. So I'm delighted you're here. And it's 8:30. And those of you who can go to sleep, we encourage you to get as much sleep as you can. And those of you who feel like the last thing you want to do is go to sleep and you're raring to start practicing, and the meditation hall is always open and you're welcome to sit here and practice as long as you'd like. And the wake-up bell will be at 5:30, and the sitting here is at 6. For those of you who haven't been here before, there's that's called Sangha service at 6:40. And the managers are wandering around the building during that time. It's available to support you if you don't know where your tools are or exactly what to do, or you have some questions about it. They'll be close by, and you can find them, and they'll support you. Good night.